From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the two worlds of Sylvester Monroe. He grew up in a Chicago housing project, but got out of the ghetto through scholarships to prep school in Harvard. Now he's a correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Recently, Monroe returned to the project to write about his early life and what has become of his childhood friends. Also today, we talked to soprano saxophonist Jane Ira Bloom, a woman who's made it in the mostly male-dominated world of jazz. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from the Dreamland Syncopators, a modern band that plays faithful recreations of vintage big band music. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Almost Grown, the new series that traces one couple's relationship from pimples to post-divorce. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Sylvester Monroe grew up in a huge ghetto housing project on Chicago's South Side called the Robert Taylor Homes. He got out of the ghetto in 1966 through a scholarship to prep school, which in turn led him to Harvard. Monroe learned to live in the two extremes of American society, poverty and privilege, but he never felt completely a part of either world. Sylvester Monroe is now a national correspondent for Newsweek, covering the White House and politics. In the spring of 1986, he returned to the Robert Taylor Homes and asked the friends he grew up with if he could write about them for Newsweek. With the help of several colleagues, Monroe profiled his friends, showing the range of experiences of black men who came of age in the ghetto in the 1960s. It was published as a Newsweek cover story in March of 1987 and has been expanded for the new book, Brothers. Sylvester Monroe told me that his interest in writing about black men in America was in part a reaction to other stories on the subject he'd seen in the media.
The media seemed to have rediscovered in the last 3 to 4 years the so-called underclass. And in all the stories and specials that you would see, or most of them, it was from the women's point of view, mother-headed families, teenage pregnancies, and you never saw black men. They remained, in Ralph Ellison's phrase, invisible men. One of the stories that I did see that particularly annoyed me was a CBS special done by Bill Moyers entitled "The Vanishing Black Family."
Right.
In that, the only one of the few black male images you saw was of this young man who had fathered 6 illegitimate children, and he was asked by the interviewer why he kept doing that. And he says, "Well, I don't know. I guess I just got super sperm or something." And he says, "Well, who's going to take care of all these children?" And he said, "The state, I guess." Well, anyway, I was very upset by that because it was an accurate portrayal of what happens I believe it was Newark, New Jersey, in public housing projects like the Robert Taylor Homes, which is in Chicago. But it was not balanced. It was not fair. I mean, you didn't see the other side. And therefore, that's how we decided to come up with the idea to look at men and to do it from the inside out, not the usual sociology and statistics. Everybody knows the ghetto pathology, but from the inside out, to let the men speak for themselves about their lives and the world around them.
Well, I think meeting many of your old friends for this story was an occasion for you to reflect on your life, and that's what I'd like to talk with you about. Can you describe for us the housing project that you grew up in?
Sure. The Robert Taylor Homes is the largest public housing project in the country. It's 28 16-story high-rise buildings that stretch for about 2.5 miles along State Street, the main street in the city of Chicago. They opened in 1962. Oddly, when they opened, they were sort of heralded as an innovative concept in public housing. In fact, for my family, and for many of the families of the people in this book and others, the Robert Taylor Homes represented the best place many of us had ever lived. I mean, my family had lived in one sort of rat-infested, roach-infested tenement slum after another. And moving here, I mean, here was a place that was new, it was well-kept, all the appliances worked, it was warm in the winter. It was just really, it symbolized hope and a new beginning.
Did it stay that way for long?
No. A couple of things happened. One of the things that made, the Robert Taylors are a much different place today, than they were in the mid to late 1960s. When we moved in, one of the things that characterized is that the people who lived there, we're talking Robert Taylor Homes at its peak had 27,000 people, all poor, all black. Now it's about 19,000. But even though it was a place for poor people, the people there were black people who had come up in the post-war migration from Mississippi, from the South. And even though there weren't always two parents in the families, the families were very strong. They were church-rooted. They had very strong values, and parents had control of their children. Today, parents are much younger, and they don't exercise that kind of control. We're talking about 17, 18, 19, 20, 20-year-old, 21-year-old girls trying to raise families or raise children. In Jesse Jackson's phrase, babies raising babies. They can't exercise that control. The influence of the church is not as strong as it was. These young people cannot impart the kind of values that our parents did. I mean, we were in gangs. Also, the gangs were just taking hold then. For us, being in the gang was not because we were gangsters. I mean, as tough as we were in our own minds, I mean, we're talking about guys who were supposed to be tough who had to be in the house when the lights came on.
Right.
And if you
what,
know, I mean,
what your mothers had counted, your mothers really had authority.
Yes, they did. They had authority, and we respected that authority. Mm-hmm. That's changed. One of the reasons it's changed, as I said, is the difference is of the family structure. The other is the impact of drugs. Drugs were something that, for us, I mean, at that time, we knew what marijuana was and that sort of thing, but it was something that, quote, bad boys did. And we didn't do that. Now, the impact of cocaine and crack and the enormous amounts of money that can be made have made the projects a much more violent and dangerous place to be.
My guest is Sylvester Monroe, a reporter for Newsweek and author of the new book Brothers, which is about the lives of he and his friends from a Chicago housing project where he grew up. When you were in school in Chicago, you were very smart. Your friends nicknamed you Brainiac. Did you like that name and like having the reputation of being the smart kid?
Oddly enough, I didn't particularly like the nickname. And, I mean, as kids, adolescents at that age, you really don't want to stand out. You really don't want to be all that much different.
And it's sometimes not a compliment to be called smart when you're young.
That's right. I didn't try not to be smart, but I also didn't sort of push it. What I really wanted to be was cool, like the rest of the guys on the street. I mean, I looked up one of the guys, Half Man Carter. I mean, he could dance, he could sing, he had girlfriends. He was one of the first of us to ever get little summer jobs and term time jobs after school and on the weekends. So he had money. Was pretty good with girls. He dressed nice, and those were the things that I really kind of wanted to be. I went to school. I mean, I did not do well in school. I went to school because of my parents' influence. But no, it was not necessarily a compliment.
Well, you got into a special program to go to St. George's School, which is a prep school, and it was called the ABC program, which stood for A Better Chance.
Right.
Did you want to go? Did you want to leave your home and go to Rhode Island to go to a prep school?
Absolutely not. I mean, I was doing pretty well at Wendell Phillips High School, which was a little bit up the street from the Robert Taylor homes, about 4,000 students then, all black, a school with a reputation for the worst of everything. Mm-hmm. But yet, I was going to school there, and I was sort of just coming into my own. I was learning about girls, and I was getting straight A's. I was on the track team, and really starting to come into my own. And I really didn't want to leave my family, my friends, this environment where I didn't have to work that hard. I worked, but not that hard. And now they were telling me that I had to go to a place which, you know, to me it was like a galaxy far, far away, in Newport, Rhode Island, somewhere I'd studied in social studies, in geography. I did not want to go. My mother, however, in her wisdom, recognized that this was an opportunity that I really couldn't pass up. And basically, I knew, too. I knew that my life would change, mm-hmm. would never be the same. So I went, but I went with the intention of coming right back. My mother
right.
said, you don't have to. I mean, she said, just go and check it out. See what it's like. If you don't like it, you can come home. So,
well, actually, after a few weeks, you asked her to come home, and she refused to let you come.
That's right. She said the only way I could come home was in a box.
Tell us the story of what happened when you got to school and one of the teachers looked at your clothes and told you to buy new ones. What were you wearing?
I was wearing my best Southside Chicago street garb. which I and when he when this teacher who was my appointed my as my advisor saw me, I thought he was admiring what I was wearing. I was wearing a black a big black hat with a black and white weave band, a long collar knit shirt, a pair of reversible pleated baggy pants, and a pair of black and white Stacy Adams wingtips, the kind that you could see the stitches, the white stitches around the soles, and a pair of dark glasses. He looked at me and he said, do you have other clothes? And I thought he was admiring them. He said, yeah, just like this. And the next day he took me off and bought me a blue blazer, two pairs of gray flannels, and a pair of black tie shoes, because he said my Stacy's would not do for Sunday chapel.
So you got the point pretty quick that you were supposed to look and dress differently than you were used to.
Yeah, I mean, different. He wanted to. I mean, it made me look the part of a St. George's school. I mean, New England boarding school, preppy, but I really wasn't. At least not yet.
Well, this brings to mind a statement that you make in your book. You say that the school prided itself on being colorblind, but to you, that sometimes meant colorblind was that well, black people could be just like white people. Mm-hmm. Is that how it seemed to you?
Yeah, that's it, and it's one of the great myths about what integration was all about, the struggle for integration, which was it was never really about black people mimicking white people and being like them and sort of shedding their exterior, because in effect that really can't happen. I mean, the one self-evident thing about me as a black American, as a black man, is my blackness. I mean, even if I wanted to, I could not escape it. If when I walk out into the street in the morning, the first thing that people see is that blackness.
Well, if you were expected to change your clothes and dress more of the part of a preppy, were there certain emotions, certain feelings that you were supposed to trade in for new ones as well?
Exactly. I mean, I was one of the things. Well, a teacher. I'd been there for very long, and a teacher once came up to me and asked me and said to me, "You must be really happy to be and grateful to be away from that awful place where you came from, the Robert Taylor Homes." And he was flabbergasted when I said to him that I was not. That, in fact, I was a little bit resentful that I had to go more than 1,000 miles to get a good education, to leave everybody that I knew and loved, my family, my sisters, my mother, my brother, all my friends, back on the south side of Chicago, as if there was something different about me than them, that I was somehow better than them. And I never was comfortable with that idea, with that notion, and have always resisted it. And that is part of what Brothers is all about, this book, the kinship between me and those guys and the kinship between all black people.
When you were in Chicago, you were seen as a brainiac, the smart one, the intellectual kid. When you were in prep school, were you seen as the tough guy just by virtue of having come from a Southside Chicago housing project?
A little bit, but I didn't play that up. I mean, I really, the funny thing was that I had a hard time getting the white kids at the school. There were only about 5 of us black students at the school when I arrived. No black student had ever graduated from St. George's. And I had a hard time getting them. I would tell them stories about the south side of Chicago and where I'd come from and the Blackstone Rangers, which was this burgeoning street gang at that time, which would soon to become one of the most fierce and largest street gangs in America. They just simply didn't believe it. I mean, they sort of looked at me with this disbelief that I was making up these stories. But I didn't try to come off. I mean, the thing was that when I was at St. George's School, for the most part, I acted the part of you know, a young prep school, boarding school student. But when I went back to St. George, I mean, when I went back to the Robert Taylor Homes, on the other hand, I shed all of that, and I took none of that home. I never wore that blue blazer and those gray flannels back down on 39th Street.
Well, did it feel kind of schizophrenic to have to be two different people depending on which world you were in?
It very, very much. And it created, what it also did was created a bit of anxiety about who I was and what I was and where I belonged. And an incredible amount of guilt. I mean, for the first, I was at St. George's for 3 years. Then I graduated and went to Harvard. And by the time I got to Harvard, I mean, the guilt was something, I mean, I didn't dwell on it, but it was always sort of there in the back of my mind. Because at Harvard University, I lived in a dorm that overlooked the Charles River, beautiful sunsets, great big picture window. I lived much better than I had ever lived in the Robert Taylor Homes or anywhere else. And there was a certain amount of guilt about the fact that I had left my friends, who I thought, you know, why can't they have this opportunity? Why didn't they get this opportunity? Why is it just me? Why is my mother and my sisters and brothers still back in the, on the south side of Chicago?
Well, I want to talk with you more about what that period of your life was like, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Newsweek reporter Sylvester Monroe, who's written a new book called Brothers, about growing up in a housing project and also about his friends who grew up there with him. And he looks at what happened to them in their lives and what happened to him in his life. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Sylvester Monroe is my guest, author of the new book, Brothers. When you were in Harvard, and you got to Harvard in, was it 68?
69.
69, okay. Well, this was about the time that a lot of college students were becoming very political or becoming dropouts in a way, spending less time on schoolwork, more time on either political actions or taking drugs, having sexual relationships, things like that, and paying a lot less attention to school. What was that like for you to have your encounter with Harvard, you know, coming from like a ghetto housing project? Here you are at Harvard. You're supposed to really be hunkering down and proving yourself and, you know, proving that a black student can make it in Harvard. And students all around you are probably deciding, well, the heck with academia. They're gonna like hang out.
Well, I too got caught up in that. In fact, I was almost kicked out of Harvard my freshman
year.
For taking over buildings.
Oh, right.
I took over, I was part of a group that took over University Hall freshman year. And, I mean, it was a bright, wild-eyed time of idealism. And we were going to change this. We came in, we were going to change this 330-some-odd-year-old institution at that time. And the problem was that, we figured, we bought the myth. I bought the myth that here was the best and the brightest in the country of students. And we were going to come in and tell Harvard how to do it and tell them what was wrong. And it took me a good 2 years before I realized, before I finally came to realize what I was there for, and that this institution was simply not going to change because I said, a 19-year-old black kid from the south side of Chicago said it should change. I was one of the luckier ones. There were some people who simply never did make the adjustment that to sort of hunker down and realize that we were there to get an education and not change the world.
When you had become radicalized and were taking over buildings, what about your friends in Chicago who were still living in the housing projects? How did activism play out there, and did they relate to your new radicalized politics?
They did not. As a matter of fact, what happened was, as I went away to school, about a year to 18 months after I went away to prep school, many of these guys, not all of them, many of these guys dropped out of high school and went to the Army. A couple of them picked up that sort of activism in the service, in the Army, and came back. But one of the guys who didn't go, I remember one of the guys came back wearing a dashiki and dark glasses and sort of black power thing. And Half Man Carter, who was, I mentioned earlier, one of the guys, and he never went away to the service, never went away anywhere, really came back and says, nah, we don't do that down here on Trey 9. So down on the block, that activism never really picked up. I mean, even though that we'd lived through the periods of urban riots in the late 60s, 67, 68, and then the death of Martin Luther King, the riots, that never really caught on down on 39th Street in the projects. The agenda down there was sort of just staying alive.
Did you try to politicize your friends, or did that seem not right?
No, I'm not sure why. I mean, I just had this feeling in the same way that I never took the blue blazer and gray flannels of St. George's School back to 39th Street. I also never took that activism, that sort of political activism back to 39th Street. I just felt that if it wasn't there, I mean, that it wasn't natural. I mean, I still did not want to rock the boat, and I still very much wanted to be accepted by my friends on the block. So, no, I did not. I continued to live two completely separate lives.
Sylvester Monroe is my guest. He's a reporter for Newsweek and author of the new book, Brothers. He grew up in a Chicago housing project and went on to prep school in Harvard. And that's partially the subject of his new book. The rest of the book is about what happened to his friends who grew up in the same housing project. In your book, you write, I'm neither a true preppy nor a ghetto banger. I am rather the peculiar product of an even more peculiar hybrid of American experience. Do you find yourself in a position now where you really want to find other people like you who know both of those worlds and are a part of each but aren't kind of in the middle somewheres or not? I don't
actively look for those kind of people. I've actually become very comfortable with who I am and what I am, and that, and finally stop. I mean, it's just one of the things about doing Brothers. I mean, it was kind of a catharsis. I came full circle in my own life, and I looked, and I suddenly realized that really I don't have to choose one or the other. I mean, I don't really belong in either place. I certainly don't belong on 39th Street, and I don't belong, in off Capitol Hill in Washington D.C. where I now live. But that 39th Street is where I'm from. And that, in fact, I'm a privileged character because I have two windows on the world and a dual window on the world. And what I do in my job as a national correspondent for Newsweek and just as a human being who has this experience is to try and get people in both places to just accept that there may be a different way of looking at the world. Not that you have to agree with it or accept it, but that it just accept that there is a valid point of view, a valid worldview, that if you just stop for a minute and think it's valid and it's legitimate, even though I might not agree with it, we've made a little bit of progress. That's what I try to do. That is the point of Brothers. It was to get Newsweek readers and people who will read this book, hopefully, to look at the place, people who would never go to a place like the Robert Taylor Homes and who have in their heads a preconceived idea, notion about what goes on there and who lives there and what life is like there, to realize that really who lives there are people with the same dreams, hurts, hopes, needs, wants as everybody else. It's just that their lives are circumscribed by race and poverty and the isolation of living in a place like the Robert Taylor Homes.
Now, you've told us before when you used to go back to the Robert Taylor Homes on school breaks that you wouldn't bring, you know, the college clothes, that you wouldn't bring certain politics that you had started to believe in and take part in. Now, when you went back to the Robert Taylor Homes as a Newsweek correspondent to write the story about the lives of your friends and what kind of adults they had become and how, what did you feel comfortable taking back all of the things that you had become, you know, dressing the way you dress on the job or...
Yeah, I mean, what if there was any discomfort, it was about what I suspected, what I knew and suspected I would find and how I would handle it. I mean, these weren't just any old subjects. I mean, I'd been back to the Robert Taylors over the years. That's what made this possible. And I think ultimately the way that I went back, I mean, because these guys could have resented me. I mean,
well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, well, here I am, a successful Newsweek correspondent. I think I'll write about you guys.
But that's
Right. I'm sure it's not the way you did it, but you'd have to be careful for it to not be perceived that way.
Oh, and there was some suspicion. I mean, when I went back, one of the guys, Ulysses Sonny Spruill, looked at me and said, Vest, are you the man? I mean, are you the police? Why are you here? And it didn't take me long to convince him that I wasn't, but the point is that he asked, and he was serious. Another of them, Gregory Bronson, looked at me and said, you know, I'll do this for you as a favor. Because you asked, and, you know, we were friends, we are friends, and I'll do this, but you know and I know that those white people you work for are not going to do any kind of positive story about black men. There was that skepticism. Ultimately, these guys did it because, and I think because, even though I never had this in mind that I would come back and do this, and that I would need an entree back in with these guys, I really did feel that kinship. And so I never went back sort of beating on my chest, talking about, look at what I did, look at who I am and what I am now. If you had done this or that, you could have been just like me. I simply went back as Vest Monroe. I mean, I didn't make any, there was no pretense that I was still one of the guys on the block. I mean, they knew that I was a Newsweek correspondent, but I treated them in the same way that I always had. Ultimately, I think Half Man Carter gave the best answer as to why these guys did it. He said to me, in 36 years as a black man, no one had ever asked me what I thought about anything. And, you know, it's not every day that most people get a chance to have that kind of forum in Newsweek to talk about themselves and their lives, and certainly not black men.
The person who was nicknamed Half Man was your best friend when you were growing up. What happened to him now? What's he doing now?
Well, Half Man sort of epitomizes, I mean, of these 11 guys, you've got a real spectrum. I mean, this represents a kind of microcosm of what happens to black men in America. I mean, not that all black men are grow up in housing projects like the Robert Taylor, but there were some guys who were very successful, some who were not. And in the middle are guys like Half Man Carter, who, as I said, worked hard. I mean, breaks the myth about black men in housing projects like the Robert Taylor's that they are lazy. Half Man, the one thing that I remember about him is he always had a job from the time he was 13. Sometimes he had two jobs. But while we looked up to him when we were 16 years old because he had money in his pocket and he had a job and he had nice clothes, because he dropped out of school and opted to take that to work and make that money, the money he makes at 37 now is not much different than the money he made at 16. But still, he works. I mean, he believes in the work ethic. He'd never been on welfare. And what he says is, you know, he chooses work. I mean, and that's black America. That's the bulk of black America. It's not the Vess Monroes. It's not the Ray Stinglys, who's a successful pharmaceutical salesman, guy who grew up in a family of 12 children. It's not Hunk Johnson, the guy who looked around and decided that there was no possibility of him making it in the straight world. So he became a hustler. He's today doing 8 years for armed robbery. Or Billy Harris, who became a basketball player, professional basketball player, but when the ABA folded where he played, he found himself back on the streets. They're in the middle. The guys who haven't had that big break, but haven't turned to drugs or crime, they just work hard every day trying to make ends meet.
And you think that those are the people who are the most invisible?
Yes.
We have just 2 seconds left. Tell me really quickly, do you think a big trap that a lot of successful people who had a hard time making it fall into is thinking, well, if I made it, why can't other people?
It is a fallacy because, I mean, we are one person. And the point, one of the points of Brothers is the interchangeability of our lives. Hunk Johnson could have been Vess Monroe. Vess Monroe could have been Hunk Johnson if just a couple of things had gone a little bit different. I was lucky, and defining luck as the intersection between preparation and opportunity. I got some things from my family, love, support, a sense of self-worth, and a pushing toward to understand that the importance of education that made it possible when the doors of opportunity swung open in the late 1960s for me to take advantage of it. Those guys didn't have that same push, that same break.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Newsweek correspondent Sylvester Monroe. His new book, Brothers, is about growing up in one of Chicago's biggest housing projects. It's about him and about the friends he grew up with. It's published by Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with reporter Thurston Clark. His new book, Equator, chronicles his very hot 2-year trip across the middle of the Earth. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Soprano saxophonist Jane Ira Bloom cut her first album when she was still in college. Now 10 years and 5 albums later, Bloom's been called one of the best soprano players in all of jazz. Coming up, we talk with Jane Ira Bloom about her music. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews Territory Jazz, the new album from the Dreamland Syncopators. Kevin says their collection of tunes from the late 20s shows how even then jazz had spread beyond New Orleans, Chicago, and New York. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Almost Grown. It's a new ABC series that follows one couple's relationship through the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President-elect George Bush announced today that he will keep 2 more cabinet secretaries already serving President Reagan, Attorney General Richard Thornburgh and Education Secretary Laurel Cavazos. And Bush named his choice for one of the key economic policy posts in the federal government, Richard Darman, as Director of the Office of Management and Budget. NPR's Jim Angle has details.
Vice President Bush said Darman has an intricate knowledge of the federal government, understands the numbers, and will help make sure the Bush administration hits the ground running in its battle against the deficit. Dick Darman has an enormous job ahead of him, Bush said, a job in which the president-elect said he would have an active role.
There will be a lot of day-to-day contact between the director of the Office of Management and Budget and the president, and I hope that that will signal to the country my determination to keep the U.S. on a sound economic course and to battle our battle against this large federal deficit.
Though he doesn't take office until January 20th, Bush said he'll keep saying he'll do something about the deficit because, as he put it, there is a psychology out there where people need a certain reassurance. Darman said when it comes time for cuts, the administration will have to look at all social programs except Social Security. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Bush met with former Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter today, who advised the president-elect to raise federal taxes on tobacco, alcohol, and gasoline, and cut spending in defense and other areas to lower the deficit. Bush has made a number of moves in the past 2 weeks to strengthen the confidence of the financial markets, but his repetition of a pledge not to raise taxes sent the dollar sharply lower, NPR's Barbara Mantell reports.
At his White House press briefing, Vice President Bush said he was not going to change his view on how to reduce the federal budget deficit. Soon after Bush's statements were reported, the value of the dollar, which had stabilized at the end of last week after central banks intervened in the currency markets, renewed its decline. The dollar ended the day lower against most major currencies, as traders continued to worry if Bush and Congress would be able to agree on a way to cut the U.S. federal budget deficit. A lower dollar helped to depress the stock market through most of the day. However, in the last few minutes of trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average managed to eke out a small gain, rising a little more than 3 points to close at 2065.97. In New York, I'm Barbara Mantell reporting.
U.S. District Court Judge Gerhard Gesell today told former White House aide Oliver North that he could not wrap himself in the cloak of the presidency to justify his role in diverting Iranian arms sales profits to the Nicaraguan Contras. North's defense attorneys have suggested that North was simply implementing foreign policy decreed by the president and is therefore not subject to prosecution. Gesell did not take action on defense motions to dismiss charges against North, but did say there is no evidence the president directed the diversion of the Iranian funds. Gesell also indicated he could not take any testimony in the Iran-Contra case in secret, since the Constitution does not permit that. Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin today accused Egypt of violating the spirit of the Camp David Accords. That, in response to Egypt's decision to recognize the independent state proclaimed by the Palestine National Council. Israel's foreign minister summoned the Egyptian ambassador for consultations, while in Cairo, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak met with PLO chief Yasser Arafat. In Brussels, the European community said it welcomed discussions, or rather decisions, made by the Palestine National Council as positive steps toward Middle East peace, but stopped short of recognizing the Palestinian homeland. To mark the 25th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy, former Peace Corps volunteers today began a 24-hour vigil at the Capitol in Washington. Kennedy founded the Peace Corps in 1961, shortly after taking office, to send mostly young volunteers to undeveloped nations. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the stereotyped view of jazz history is that the music was born in New Orleans, sailed upriver to Chicago in 1917, and had moved to New York by 1930. And he says some critics still think of jazz pretty much that way, that all the best players gravitate to one place, where the action is. But even in the 1920s, jazz bands were springing up all over the country. A new album by a group called the Dreamland Syncopators recreates some of the music played by these outpost bands. Kevin says the record is an enjoyable history lesson.
In classical music circles, you hear a lot of talk about authentic performance practices. Playing old pieces in the exact style in which they were first performed, the way they would have sounded to the composer. In jazz, authentic performance is an old concept. It's what the whole Dixieland revival of the 1940s was about. Of course, a lot of Dixieland stunk, giving revivalism a bad name, but the best modern revivalists hear and play early jazz better than those Dixielanders, even if the mainstream jazz press ignores them. That's Mary Lou Williams' composition, Mesa Stomp, first recorded by Andy Kirk's band in Kansas City in 1929. But this version was made in London in 1986 by the Dreamland Syncopators. That's a 10-piece band co-led by the British pianist Keith Nichols and the German clarinetist and saxophonist Klaus Jacoby. It's from an album called Territory Jazz on the Stomp Off label. The term territory jazz refers to early big bands based in Los Angeles, Kansas City, San Antonio, Richmond, anywhere except New York or Chicago. Nichols and Jacoby have transcribed and re-recorded late 1920s performances by a dozen territory bands, playing the arrangements straight but improvising solos in the period style. Their recreations can be amazingly faithful. The Syncopators make you forget themselves so you can concentrate on that old music. Before we hear their remake of Ozark Mountain Blues, listen to a bit of the 1929 original by the Missourians, the band that later became Cab Calloway's orchestra. Now here's the 1986 remake. There are some subtle differences between the two versions. The new one is a tiny bit faster and smoother, and a tuba has been added to the introduction. But the banjoist's part is accurate right down to the moments where he switches from strumming to finger picking. The best composition the Syncopators play is Charlie Lawrence's Charlie's Idea, first recorded by Paul Howard's Quality Serenaders in Hollywood in 1929. Thank you. Charlie's Idea, the ragtime and march echoes and the contrasting instrumental breaks recall the music of Jelly Roll Morton, who'd spent several years in Los Angeles between 1917 and 1923. But by 1929, when Charlie's Idea was recorded in L.A., Morton's influence on Californians probably came from the records he was then cutting in the Midwest. Ever since the first Jazz 78 came out in 1917, the music's been disseminated more through recordings than live performances. So in a sense, the whole notion of territory jazz is misleading. It implies a cultural isolation that didn't quite exist. But by playing splendid old music from the territories, this Anglo-German band reminds us again that good jazz often comes from out-of-the-way places.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Territory Jazz, a new album from the Dreamland Syncopators on the Stomp Off label. This is Fresh Air. Jane Ira Bloom is one of a small but growing number of women making her mark as a jazz composer and instrumentalist. For the last 2 years, Bloom has won the Downbeat Critics Poll for soprano saxophonists deserving wider recognition. New York Times music critic Stephen Holden says Bloom has emerged as one of the most acclaimed players in a younger generation of jazz musicians who, instead of turning their back on electronic technology, are finding ways to use it in a creatively exploratory manner. NASA recently invited Bloom to participate in its documentary art program, and she's working on a composition inspired by last September's space shuttle launch. Bloom has a new album called Slalom. Most of the tracks are her original compositions and feature her playing with and without electronic processing.
You could say I'm an improvisational composer and a compositional player. Somehow I've always found that the most successful pieces for me have been when they have become one, when a listener really isn't aware where the writing stops and where the improvising begins. So for me it's a challenge, and I feel like it's a challenge for the players.
You play mostly your own compositions, but you also do some standards. On your new album, there's a couple of standards. Both of them are songs, really. I Loves You, Porgy, and If I Should Lose You. And I wonder what brings you back to songs, to good songs.
Well, it's a part of me. It's a part of my musical experience when I was growing up. I suppose when I pick a ballad to record, I feel pretty much like the piece has to mean something to me. You know, it might be the lyric, or it might be the melodic, you know, melodic ideas that are going on it, but it has to be something special, at least for me, to want to go about making my own version of it.
Soprano become your instrument?
Well, it's always hard to figure it out. When I look back on it, it seems almost as if the instrument chose me. I played alto, like many saxophone players. But as I began to study the instrument, I spent a lot of time on it, and I started to find I could do things on it that I couldn't do on the other horns. And little by little, it sort of became my voice.
Lately, you've been using electronics with your soprano. You call it your gizmo. I don't really know what it is. Maybe you could explain it.
Well, again, the gizmo was one particular device I used. It was a prototype that we came up with. Basically, what I use is a very archaic system of effects boxes. This is definitely not state-of-the-art electronic equipment by any means, but it is stuff that it's an arrangement that I feel is honest in that it's very spontaneous and live oriented, and there's no pre-programming or post-programming. What you hear is what you get, and what you hear on the record is what I actually do in real time in performance.
Do you like to use the electronics consistently through a piece, or use it for color at intervals within the piece?
All depends on the piece. Some pieces are built around electronic idea. Other times, I'm very conscious of trying to make a blend between acoustic and electronic, and I think about that very consciously, like a composer would, how to make those two blend seamlessly. And I like rapid change, so I do trigger the sounds on and off a lot.
Are still in the minority in the world of jazz instrumentalists. There's a growing number of women, but it's still far from equal, proportionately. Many of the men who I've interviewed, many of the male jazz musicians I've interviewed, have talked about how it was always easier to pick up girls if you were a musician. And a lot of men have even told me that they gave up drums because it took too long to put the drum kit away and all the women would be gone by then.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I was wondering if this is exactly the kind of thing that might make it a little difficult for a woman instrumentalist to be quickly accepted by a band that was comprised of men. Because, especially when you're young, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're a teenager in your 20s and picking up people is really on everybody's mind. A woman instrumentalist could be perceived as somebody that would get in the way.
Well, there's a certain aspect to what you're saying is true. And like you said, especially when you're young and you're trying to, make a musical statement. And trying to be rather pure in your musical interests. I almost don't know what to make of it because somehow I found my way through that. You're right, it does take time, and you have to be patient with people in their process of getting to know you, and especially getting to know your music. And probably being a woman has a part in that. And it probably has a lot more to do with sociology than it does with music, but more likely than not, it seems to have taken more time than I had ever thought it would to connect with those musicians. And I seem to think now, looking back at my small 10 years pursuing music in the professional realm, that perhaps the adversity and the difficulties that I had to deal with on one hand were actually strengthening, because unlike most young saxophonists, when I began my career, I went off on a path that was rather unusual. I didn't see very many opportunities. The opportunities just didn't come. The phone didn't ring like I thought it was gonna. So it forced me into choosing the only choice I had, which was to be a leader and to figure out situations for myself, how to play, how to perform, how to record. I see that as an element in how I shape my own career. So on the one hand, I have to look and see that there really were positive benefits from having to deal with a certain amount of challenge and sort of adversity in the environment, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know? And you know, in those times, if the phone isn't ringing and you're not getting offered dates, you don't really know for sure, I think, whether it's sexism or whether people genuinely aren't calling you for musical reasons. There's no empirical way of knowing these things.
No, it's a covert kind of discrimination. You'll never know. And musicians have an ability to be kind of single-minded about what it is that they do. And I have to admit, I'm probably like in that respect. Music was everything in my mind, and all these social ramifications really existed in the periphery. I'm not even sure how aware I was of half of it when I was going about doing what I was doing. I was just so impassioned with wanting to play mm-hmm. and wanting to do it that I had to become very creative about how I went about doing it.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.
Soprano saxophonist Jane Ira Bloom. Her new album, Slalom, is on Columbia Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with guest host Alex Chadwick. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Terry.
What's new in the news?
Well, Vice President Bush has some new appointments coming for his administration coming in January. Colonel Oliver North was back in court today asking for a ruling on some secrecy issues, secrecy of some documents, a big issue in his trial. We'll have a report on that. And reporter John Burnett has been going to some local Ku Klux Klan meetings. He's got a big story coming up tonight. About a third of the program this evening, actually, on what the Klan is doing today to change its image and why. And we'll also listen to some of a new collection of the works of Hoagy Carmichael.
Thanks, Alex. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but it doesn't always ensure success. Television critic David Bianculli says this is the case with the new series Almost Grown.
Almost Grown is a new CBS series that steals ideas and attitudes from three successful ABC series. Like 30-something, it's about the give and take and ups and downs of romantic relationships. Like Moonlighting, it's about two attractive people who spend as much time fighting with each other or pursuing other people as they do enjoying each other's company. And like The Wonder Years, it's a remembrance of things past, going back with loving detail to the 60s. But Almost Grown doesn't stop with the 60s. It also dramatizes the 70s and the 80s in a storyline that follows a particular romance, from innocent high school days to boisterous college nights, and finally to marriage, divorce, and a thoroughly modern post-divorce relationship. It's like watching 30-something with flashbacks, so that you have to sit through scenes of 20-something and 10-something. And since 30-something drives me up a wall, it's not surprising that most of Almost Grown drives me up the wall, across the ceiling, and down the other side. The triple-decade approach isn't such a bad idea, but the clichés in Almost Grown get to be really irritating. When it's 1962, writer-director David Chase and co-writer Lawrence Connor make sure to name-drop the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Ed Sullivan Show, and the death of Buddy Holly. And in the background, or sometimes the foreground, there's always the music. In this scene, where the young hero's father comes home from work, the music blaring from the kitchen radio becomes the center of attention.
Hi, honey. Spare ribs.
Don't start with me. Anybody. Norman, turn that crap down.
That's James Brown.
It's his problem. Thank God in a couple years it'll all be gone and forgotten in the dust.
I don't know, Dad. It's like a force. Rock and roll could even become like a huge business.
Norman, in order for something to catch on big in this country, they gotta be able to use it to sell products. Can you imagine TV commercials with rock and roll in them? Selling cars or pants or soda pop?
Why is that scene so awful? Let me count the ways. First, it's not realistic. That's not a 60s conversation. That's dialogue written from an 80s perspective so that audiences can enjoy the irony, except that it's too obvious to be enjoyable. Second, it's a straight steal from the gruff father on the Wonder Years. Finally, like other segments from other decades, this scene from Almost Grown trivializes the times rather than illuminates them. If you want a better look at what you can do with high school kids in 1962, take another look at American Graffiti. As for Almost Grown, I'll spare you scenes from the 70s and 80s. Even though the show's stars, Timothy Daly and Eve Gordon, get better as their characters get older, going back to the future isn't any more fun than revisiting the 60s. Almost every 70s clip is saturated with the Chambers Brothers' Time Has Come Today. And the current stuff is like getting an advance peek at the fifth season of 30-something. I'll pass. Being as generous as I can, I'll concede that better scripts, much better scripts, could make Almost Grown almost work. The way it stands now, though, the most honest thing about the show is its title. Most of it is so bad, it makes you almost grown.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Time has come today.
Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, David Ray reads and discusses the poems in Sam's book, a collection that mourns his son, who died at the age of 19 in a drinking accident. Also, Ed Ward profiles New Orleans rocker Lloyd Price, who had hits with the song Personality and Stagger Lee. And book critic John Leonard reviews Parting the Waters, America in the King Years by Taylor Branch. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.